Creative Director Sonia Green, Director of Production Initiatives Lisa Rudman, Producers Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, and Monica Lopez. Web updates by Sabine Blazin. And I'm this week's host, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are talking with Sean, a visual artist who has been on KBOO before and had some recent exhibition that I had a chance to see, and I just loved it. And we're talking tonight with Sean about their work and about how their work intersects with gender and trans and non-binary issues. So, Sean, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. Hi. How are you?
Good. So you've been on KBOO before then?
Yeah, I was on Preference with Alan a couple years ago.
Oh, great. Well, you're a KBOO pro. anyways, welcome to Transpositive. So you are a visual artist. Do you identify as trans or non-binary?
Identify as trans, just kind of like across the board. There's no real destination, I don't think. Yeah.
Great. And you're a visual artist. So let's start by talking, let's talk about your visual art first, and then maybe we can come back and talk about gender. But first, I would just like to kind of get a sense of who you are and what you do. So could you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah. My work kind of straddles multiple spheres, I suppose. A lot of people would classify it as video work. I kind of call it performative installations. I kind of try to set up scenarios where my virtual body or a simulated body is kind of doing the labor of a performance for me. On like a performative loop, but my work really like straddles every sort of field. I throw a yearly party with my collaborators, Nick Peterson and Gabe Saar, called Mental Health Club, and have been in like the queer nightlife realm for like a while too.
So your work, is there some place that people can see your work if they want to, and we'll plug it at the end of the show too, but at the beginning of the show, I always like to offer that. Is there, like, do you have a YouTube channel or a website or a Facebook page or something?
Yeah, my website is just my name, so it's just Sean Chamberlain, at SeanChamberlain.net.
SeanChamberlain.net. Okay, great. So we'll make sure to get that in at the end of the show too. But so you mentioned that your work, you like to do a lot of work with video and that you also work with collaborators. And what is it about video that appeals to you? I mean, when I saw your piece, which I would really love it if you could describe your piece in your most recent exhibit, which was part of this, it was in somebody's backyard.
Yeah. So it was in a curator named Mac McFarlane and a social practice artist named Ariana Jacobs. They started a backyard exhibition space that's by appointment only. It's kind of a response to COVID.
Mac is the curator at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, isn't he?
Yeah, that's where I got my undergrad. And that's kind of how I know both of them. But that the work in that show was kind of new for me. My previous work had been really like, I was more of a perfectionist and was really concerned with how my body looked in the finished product. Really concerned kind of with, unfortunately concerned with, like normative beauty standards, just trying to like basically look as hot while I'm performing as I can. And for this show, I really tried not to do that. I tried to like make myself look as like erratic and ugly as possible, I suppose. Because that work for me was a direct response to kind of having to really sift through whiteness in this time. That's been like an attempted continual practice for me even before the George Floyd protests. But this work, I really wanted to kind of like sit with whiteness and see and try to materialize how whiteness is kind of processed. The figure in that show, I refer to them as avatars, kind of just like a simulated body of me. But that particular avatar is trying to buy a pair of Gucci slides and doesn't really care about the socio-political happenings. And then throughout the duration of the video, she's digging this hole in the ground on a green screen. And you can kind of see the wheels turning, but where she arrives is like also not at like a great place. It's mm-hmm. just kind of this like cycle that leads to nowhere almost. Mm-hmm. But the monitors that I use in like the video that I try to present are always kind of anchored to the physical space with like a bundle of Ethernet cables. And that's trying to convey this sort of suspension of this body, this performance on as like needing an actual like grounding or a plug without having to show like the ugliness of traditional like wiring and electrical. It also kind of simulates the internet and this sort of mobility and this virality and also kind of transcendence that you can have in the internet. I think it's a really like beautiful place, but it's also a really dark place. I definitely like came into my like gender, lack of gender, and like transness because of the internet. And because of this sort of like community that I was able to have from like childhood, but I also think it allowed me to perform gender in a really specific way on the internet, or even just do that in general. It allowed me to kind of have this protean moment where I could augment my body before I even like really understood what that really meant. I could, even at like 14, I was able to like Photoshop myself and do all these things in a digital space that my actual physical body might have been like limited to.
Wow, that's so interesting. That's just so interesting. I think that like for any of us who like came out after the internet, I think that we have some similar stories. Yeah. For instance, when I moved here, there was this person I knew. Her name is Susan Larson. And for like 30 years, she ran this website called Susan's Place, which was this like big underground place where like trans people went way back in the 90s when people were still on bulletin board systems.
Yeah.
And then into the 2000s too, when the internet was still very primitive. And it turns out that Susan Larson was my neighbor in Tennessee for like 15 years. And I had no clue she was trans. It was just the weirdest thing. I mean, I always knew Susan was a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I always liked her very much, but she wasn't really out, even though she had this like enormous digital impact. I mean, I don't think people understand how important Susan Larson was for people who were coming out online back in the 90s, when online was like the only place that a lot of people really were out. You know, they weren't out at home, they weren't out to their wives or to their boyfriends or whatever, you know, they were just out there. And it's
exactly,
like,
because they're like physical. That's like something that I find coming up in my work a lot, is like that physical location didn't allow them to be their embodied self. Like, it, you are sometimes limited by, I mean, we could go down a list of things that like people are less privileged or are in some sort of marginalized sect of identity, where that physicality doesn't allow them to like be who they want to be. And the internet does act in a safe space in that manner. I try really hard not to use safe spaces because I don't think they exist for anyone really anywhere. Mm-hmm. I think the closest person that you could be to could also be like the most toxic person. You just never really know with how people are performing, to be quite frank. Like, I think people don't necessarily think about, I don't think people are as cognitive about how they are performing all the time, or don't think about it in such like a macro sense. But I do think that the internet like offers a space of transcendence, and that is one of like the things that I think I try to investigate the most in my work, is the opposite of whatever this like sort of technophobic era that we're entering. I think technology is not inherently scary. The internet's not an inherently dark place or a scary place. I think that the ways in which we see tech and we see the internet utilized right now is scary. Like, I did this thing the other, I was actually talking with a friend. I was able to open my phone camera from my laptop. There's like a command thing that you can do really easily, and you can take a picture without actually having to utilize your phone. And I thought about it, and at first I was so bewildered and so like, this is gorgeous that these two things are communicating like this. And then I sat with it and I thought about it, and I was like, no, that's really scary, because it just exemplifies that anyone could open my camera. But that doesn't necessarily negate the inherent beauty in that sort of communication without humans, where they're just sort of, they have their own like life and ecosystem and communication, but it is now a scary, terrifying thing because of how it's utilized by humans versus the inherent process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before, only the things that our cats could see, like now anyone could possibly see.
Literally.
I'd like to talk about your comments because it really interested me, and it's something that I think that a lot of like white trans and non-binary folks aren't like quite getting into the depths of the conversation, even though like within the trans community, I think there's actually a lot of people who are really leading the conversation about like, how are we deconstructing our privilege as white people? It's like, we think, oh, we're trans, so we already have this marginalized identity. Why do we have to deal with some other thing? You know, but it's like, I mean, we do, because it's real. Yeah. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh yeah, for sure. This may be like a controversial hot take, but I really think that unfortunately in an era of like really intense identity politic, and not even identity politic, but like identity identification, like sometimes not from the person, but like from an outside, somebody who's not in your body, feeling the need to identify you as something, has created a hierarchy of like marginalization that we kind of have to pay attention to. Like, there is a hierarchy of needs, and I think as like white and non-binary, trans, whatever, gender fluid folks, we really need to try to understand that. Like, I owe my transness to like Black women.
And me too. Thank you.
I wouldn't have known what it was to be trans without having a community around me of sisters that were already doing that and learned from a legacy of like Black and Indigenous and trans women of color. And I'm not just saying that as like a pocket phrase to kind of like get me kudos. Like, I know, yeah, I owe a lot to Carrie Yamauchi, if you're listening, in particular, along with a collaborator and friend, Marquis, and Jay Dodd, just like these beautiful, effervescent people in my life that I really wouldn't have known about my transness or like about my femininity. I think I also learned a lot about my femininity from my mother and like from cis like female roommates that I've had in the past. There's one of my really good friends, is a poet named Lee Nishi Stratner. You should pick up her book, Bone Honey, everyone. It's really good.
Her book is called Bone Honey?
Mm-hmm.
And her name again?
Lee Nishi Stratner.
How would you spell that? Could you spell that?
Yeah, L-E-I-G-H and then N-I-S-H-I-S-T-R-A-T-T-N-E-R.
Great, and that's called Bone Honey. Thank you.
Yeah, and her Instagram is just xwaifu. She is also sharing a lot of resources for our community and our Black community members during this time. But living with her, I like definitely learned about my own femininity and what that meant beyond just an aesthetic thing. I think for a lot, at least for me, my transness like definitely came in steps and strides. Like, I definitely learned how to be trans aesthetically before I learned how to be like trans internally, I think. Yeah.
Boy, that's a great conversation. I've got to go to that next. What do you mean by that when you say you learned how to be trans aesthetically before you learned how to be it internally?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I think also just to not try I mean that in more of like a, I learned how to be trans, or what aesthetics of transness or queerness were through like nightlife and kind of through dressing up as like a club character and being with my friends and being wild, saying mm-hmm. wild stuff, doing wild stuff, like just being a spectacle. I think that's where I mean the aesthetics from. I definitely don't mean the aesthetics in like a trans medical, like industrial complex sort of mm-hmm. way, which is very valid. I am not on that particular journey right now, but I think that that is also a very complicated structure. But I definitely like learned how to quote, not that there's any way to look trans or be trans, but I learned kind of how to experiment and how to play with gender in that space in a really intense and kind of organic way. I think a lot of my friends, even people that I had just previously mentioned that were in that sort of scene and are now in the ballroom scene or leaders of the ballroom community in Portland, we all kind of came up at the same time, I guess, and were able to exchange these looks and ideas and conversations and this performance. I think it gets really complicated in that space also when you're only seeing people when you are performing, and then people have expectations of you as that person, I guess, or as that character. But I think a lot of my friends would attest to learning a lot about gender in that space and kind of breaking, playing with, amplifying, reducing those like binary roles. And I think that could be said for a lot of different locations and communities, obviously, in different.
The ballroom scene, though, is very unique. It's kind of a family, isn't it?
Yeah, ballroom is, I've always taken up the role of active observer in that space. There have been a couple of times where I've participated for sure, but I've always tried to like take more of a back seat in ballroom in particular. I think for me, I was able to see a sort of difference, an inherent difference between like club kids and like ballroom kids, club kids and like drag queens and ballroom kids. There's mm-hmm. obviously a lot of crossover, but I knew and understood from navigating club life that ballroom was an inherently Black and an inherently like a space for people of color to navigate. And so I hopefully tried my best to just be there to support and help out in those spaces and learn without intruding. Because I think in Portland in particular, when navigating ballroom, you have to be really careful with a really violent, violent history of whiteness here that isn't present. I mean, white supremacy and racism is present everywhere, obviously, but it doesn't have as much of like a really, really intense historical, really contemporary historical situation as Portland has. And so I think watching my friends and community members like construct that space was something really beautiful and is sort of like where things have really shifted from like clubs and parties. This is pre-COVID obviously, but I saw this massive shift from just sort of like club kids and DJs and like all that stuff to more of those people who are doing looks and all these things entering into ballroom and sort of making their own houses and making a name for themselves in that space. And then clubs sort of got more music focused, I think, mm-hmm. or look focused. I think in 2017 or 18, I think the girls were feeling very burnt out from getting dressed up 3 days in the weekend, back to back to back, and just like going out and like raging and getting paid like $100 to like be in a sweaty hot club for like mm-hmm. 6 hours, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. I mean, you kind of did a really nice full circle there towards the end, talking about ballroom culture and like kind of stepping back a little bit to like make sure that, you know, you don't let your whiteness like intrude on a space that's really a people of color centered space. And yeah. I think that kind of gets at what I was asking about in terms of like, how do we as trans folks, like really, how do we have these conversations with each other about, you know, how do we like step aside and make sure that we're making room for people of, for trans people of color?
Yeah.
And I think that some of the things that you talked about too with digital technology and how people who have the privilege to access those things can like begin on constructing their identities like even before they've gotten to them.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just kind of highlights the fact that like, you know, probably the last 12 or 14 transgender people who have been murdered this year have all been people of color.
Yeah.
And it's every year it's like this. I mean, maybe there's like 20 people of color murdered, and then maybe there's like two white people. But it's like, it shows how trans women of color and their treat, you know, this in the inner line, the intersecting levels of oppression, like are something that we especially need to be supportive of, because our sisters are being murdered. And, you know, I mean, we being trans, non-binary, I mean, yeah. we really need to care about it because these are our sisters.
And it's, if it's, I'm trying to think of another word to say other than the F word, but it's really blank that mm-hmm. We understand that like, it goes back to those, like that hierarchy of oppression. Like we are in a really, really, really blanked period of whiteness and white supremacy boiling over. And we are seeing how, like literally how blackness is, like it's inarguable how oppressed black people are in America. Mm-hmm. I guess that's more what I'm trying to say. At this point, like there's no hiding behind that anymore, that's not happening. And so it's even more upsetting and unfortunate, and also a reality that on that hierarchy of like marginalization or oppression, that here's being like transness is down here, and then you have like X, Y, Z, and then you have blackness like situated at the top, but then you also have something that's even like more intersectional and more of a target, like being trans and being black. Like unfortunately, it's like a really horrible reality, but unfortunately like that is due to like systems of oppression, that is something that we need to like hold and take care of and make sure that isn't happening, because it's also such a small group of in small community that is under attack. Black people,
These are our sisters. I mean, yeah. These are the people who, you know, these are our sisters who led the Stonewall riots. And who many of us, I mean, when we were first looking to role models, looked to trans women of color for leadership. Yeah. I mean, I did. That was the first trans woman I ever saw when I was 7 years old was a black trans woman. And she's the first person who made me realize who I was, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm so glad you acknowledged that tonight. I mean, your own story, because it was just so great to hear another, you know, say that they had gotten their, you know, learned so much about who they were from a trans woman of color.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about your work. When I saw your piece, there were so many interesting things about it. Your character was digging a hole, and the I just want to describe this if I can, and tell me if I'm not describing it right. But the character that you constructed was on a liquid crystal display screen, like a pretty decent sized one, and it was inside of a wheelbarrow that was full of mulch, and somehow you're able to turn it on so that the loop keeps on playing. And then next to the wheelbarrow, there's like a shovel, and there's some more mulch on the ground. And there's this like pink, I'm not sure, I think it's like a pink article of clothing. You'll have to remind me what it says, because I don't remember.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, and you had this great line in it that I just totally stuck with me. And you said, you know, about the revolution being televised, and like now everybody has an iPhone or a cell phone or whatever. And so, anyways, could you talk about that piece some more?
Yeah. Just so I don't forget off the top, I think the line is, they say the revolution will not be televised, but everyone has a phone with a camera, so they must be lying. And that's kind of how the video ends, or that loop ends.
Yeah, that was just like, my brain was just like, wow, Marshall McLuhan, like, you know, resurrected from the dead 40 years later with this really new radical interpretation.
Yeah, it's that in particular, I think, is probably one of like the hidden funniest moments in that work for me, because it's this sort of like pro iPhone at a protest sort of sentiment, you know, like record everything, record the police, record the march happening, otherwise like it didn't actually happen, you know. But I think it's like funny and ironic. That's the most like funny and ironic thing to me, I think, in that piece, is that that's what like liberalism and all these things like tell us to do, but really like you never want to have like your phone at a protest. Like you want to leave that at home. Like don't be taking something that can be so easily tracked. Like you don't need to be on your phone to be able to be tracked in our like day and age.
Because you can be tracked on somebody else's phone.
Exactly. Literally, I could be tracked by the helicopter that's like literally exactly. Swirling outside of my window right now, because I'm like on it. I'm like very close to like what's happening in the protests. But yeah, that work, you kind of set up the environment pretty seamlessly. It's the tube top I'm wearing in the video also, but it says feminista.
Feminista, thank you.
In rhinestones, silver rhinestones. Which is it has a matching short that I was also wearing in the video, that it's a set from Forever 21 that I just thought was the dumbest and most hilarious thing I've seen in a long time. And I knew when I saw it that I was gonna use this. I bought it like 2 years ago or something, but I knew I was going to use it for something, either a look or a work or whatever. But yeah, so you have the wheelbarrow in the dirt and the monitor, and then you have the Ethernet cable coming out of the back to look like this thing is just being autonomously powered. And I think I use that sort of Ethernet cable plug, and I use these like the tube top and the shovel as these sort of passports or portals for that, the layers of believability to be conflated. Because when I'm using, I call them prosthetics, which refers to a text by a Black critical race theory scholar named Yuri McMillan. They wrote a book called Embodied Avatars, Genealogies of Black Feminist Performance Art. And it basically moves through everyone from like Nicki Minaj and an artist named Adrian Piper, all the way back to Joyce Heath, or Heth, I believe, who was in a like Barnum and Bailey circus, I believe, as in her role was like an invalid, basically. And she was a Black woman who had to perform disability in a really, really violent way. But they basically talk about these things called prosthetics, which are objects or ephemera or whatever, that are agents of like believability for a performance, and like aid in the success of that performance being viewed from the viewer as real.
I'm curious, when you say you started with Nicki Minaj, I mean, I love Nicki Minaj. She's such a great performer. Bees in the Trap is like one of my favorite songs. It's just amazing. But how does Nicki Minaj like fit into that framework that you were just describing?
Yeah, so in that book, they basically are just like deconstructing these performances of Black women throughout history, and kind of looking at the tools that they're utilizing to have their performance the success, I guess. And in the case of Nicki Minaj, she's talking about like hyperfemininity.
Yeah.
Those sort of prosthetics, again, are these sort of like portal points for that avatar on the screen. Because then it becomes this thing where it's like, is that person on the screen like actively using these objects to sustain their own performance? Is my physical body going to come in and do the performance with the avatar? It kind of creates these layers of just like confusion, I guess, is what it's trying to get at. So that the viewer doesn't really know or can't really tell that body isn't a real body. It's just trying to limit the space between my physical body and the simulated body, and kind of not have them be two separate entities, I guess. Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. When I saw your performance, when I saw your piece, actually, I was talking to Mac, the curator, and it reminded me, because I was in San Francisco this spring. I was there in February, and I had a chance to see the Body Electric at the Yerba Buena. And the Body Electric was originally first produced, I think, like maybe 25 or 30 years ago. And this was a review of video, and mostly video art, from queer artists for the last 50 years. There were some artists who weren't queer in it, but it was definitely from the perspective of identity. So queer artists were very prominent, queer artists of color, feminists, and it goes back to like Nam June Paik, and yeah. Nam June Paik's work through like maybe the early 2000s. And when I saw your piece, it really like fit right into the framework of what the artists were doing there. Like, and when you talk about this, the work, you know, the idea of an avatar, and kind of tracing the history of performance for Black women from like, you know, the present, from like the most recent present of Nicki Minaj back to like minstrel performers from like 100 years ago. Yeah. It's so interesting because you're really getting it, like kind of the essence of why especially I think people who are like really are really needing to like work with identity, because that's like what's confronted with them as artists, turn to video and turn to performance as ways of like embodying like their truths that they are sharing or their ideas, you know. So could you talk about the idea of an avatar, because that's so interesting to me. It's like so what is an avatar to you?
Oh my gosh, I've actually never been asked that question before.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. Don't apologize at all. I think an avatar, just off the top, an avatar for me is a simulated version of the self, either amplified, de-amplified. I think it can be expanded to any sort of performance of self. Like, I guess the best way I could describe it, like right now, is, or for me, how I would describe it right now is, my physical body is like sitting in this room doing this interview with you right now, but what you're receiving on the other end is an image of me. It's the avatar of myself. My physical body is not in the room with you as if we were sitting doing a traditional interview. Like, you don't know this right now, but I have 3 ring lights on me and I'm using like a face blur filter that's like built into Zoom. So it's like the image and the projection of me that you're getting isn't like what I look like in real life necessarily. I'm able to like augment it through this digital form. I don't think an avatar has to be just digital, but for me, that's sort of the mechanism in which I deploy my avatars, I guess. And I think the reason I use an avatar in my work especially is I just have really, really gnarly anxiety. And I've performed in real spaces with physical, real avatars, like me just dressed up as a character or dressed up in a look or what have you. And that sort of like aesthetic armor that I'm using gives me like a sense of security, I guess, that like allows me to perform. But in the physical and in the real space, I don't enjoy that performance. I don't remember that performance. I personally don't get out of it what I see other people who are doing drag or who are deploying avatars in various forms in the physical. I don't get what I see and what I know they get from doing that performance, be it the attention, which that's not me being shady or anything. The attention, the notoriety, the clout, the warmth of like a stage light, the cheering, the applause. Like, I don't get what I know other people get in some sort of validation or some sort of success or like, I don't know how to necessarily describe it. Yeah, I never felt that way after doing it. And I think video for me allowed me to feel that in a sort of way. And it also allowed me to divorce myself from my work. It allowed me to be able to talk about, critique, participate in other people's critiques about my work. It allowed me that space to kind of be able to do that and separate myself from my work, because it is so identity-based. And it like allowed, there's a layer of removal that I can just be more participatory in, to be quite frank, in conversations about the work. I think video also allows me to kind of unpack the avatar a little bit more. And it also allows me to like Photoshop, and it allows me to digitally augment my body. It allows me to do these things that I couldn't do in the physical, or I couldn't do while I was performing on a stage, or performing in like a live sense, I guess. Because that's really important to me. And I think that's like obviously wrapped up in a lot of bodily trauma that I have, just like being like a larger fat bodied person. There's always an like inherent need, I think, for me in being fat, not necessarily to look skinny, but to look perfect in my fatness, I guess, because I think although I might not be afraid of my fatness, or I might have processed that, other people have not. People don't necessarily know how to navigate their fear around fat bodies, I don't think.
I think they're beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at Collins Beach last week, you know, the naked beach. I love going to Collins Beach, by the way. If you ever want to find me, that's where I am. And I was passing this like absolutely beautiful person. I mean, there's so many beautiful people there. Yeah. And they're all sizes. And this person, like, they were so beautiful. I mean, and I just thought, you know, this is nothing that I was trained to think. And it's like, I had to discover for myself how beautiful different kinds of bodies are and how completely natural and normal and just how incredibly attractive they are, you know, because I didn't get any training to tell me that that was true. I had to
Yeah, and I don't think people like think about it necessarily. I think they off the top are met with their like very, very deep rooted fears from media, from their parents, from all of these different sources, like that have built up a fear of being fat. And they're not necessarily hateful or scared of or not attracted to my body. They just don't know how to navigate that attraction, which I think expands into like transness as well, and can be said very similarly for transness. People don't know how to grapple with their own emotions, and instead they choose to project them. That was a tangent, but yeah. So I think
What really interested me about what you were saying, though, was Sean. What really interested me about what you were saying was that when you talked about the avatar and what the avatar means to you, everything was in relationship to being embodied and to doing performance. Mm-hmm. And I find that so interesting because it sounds like for me, your work fundamentally has to do with being embodied and like, you know, issues around the body, which, you know, I mean, I think that most great art is about embodiment. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it always comes back to the body. So that was so interesting. You're listening to KBOO here. We're talking transpositive, which is transgender non-binary programming, part of the queer programming block. And we're about 45 minutes into the show, and we're talking with Sean. Sean is a visual artist who deals with all kinds of issues, including issues related to trans identities. So, Sean, what else have we not gotten to yet about your work that you would like to talk about? Is there something I haven't like addressed? Because I'd like to.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I guess, sort of like. Moderately ending now, or like something that we haven't necessarily talked about. It's so interesting because I find that for myself at least, that my work is about being embodied and is about I feel like it's more about that for me than it is about transness, or it is about fatness or queerness or any of these things, because I think I just think it's really tricky, especially as a white person, to be making like work around identity. I think identity is obviously like inherent, but I think when we're making work about identity, or when people are making work about identity, a lot of times it is that's the leading thing, you know, like it's trans artists, it's black artists, it's queer artists, it's all these things instead of the access that cis and like normative white bodies have in those fields where they're just referred to as an artist and then their work is about those things. But I think a lot of times with black artists or with queer artists or with trans artists, it becomes so much about that identity that it doesn't necessarily allow for any other nuances in the work that you know that the artist is creating and thinking about in those ways. I don't know, it's something that's something that's been like brewing in my head lately. I think it's really important, obviously, for people that want to be identified as such, to be able to be identified as such. But I think there also needs to be some space for people who want the conversation, like tonight's conversation, to be sort of about being embodied, you know, and about other things that are not so niche, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like sometimes people will see my work and not, I think tonight it just was really like nice and beautiful that you were so engaged on multiple levels with the work that I'm making. But I think sometimes people want my work just because I'm a trans artist, just because I'm a queer artist, and they're marking their like diversity box, which I'm like, hey, I'm pretty low on the list of diversity.
Right.
Just letting you know, I'm like, I could send you a list of about 10 people who are more qualified and probably better suited. But I'm also not going to like feed my friends to like the culture vulture like worms that are trying to like just do that and really not think about anything else other than that diversity box, or just being like, oh, look, there's trans people here, so it's great. And it's like, no.
Do you think that any of it has to do with who's viewing and who's receiving?
Yes. A lot of it, a ton of it has to do with like consumption. I would 100% rather be happy in like conversations like this that are allowing for all those nuances to come into play. But I don't really have a ton of interest in like sitting in a room with a bunch of like cis people talking about my work in like my work as like trans work, you know? Like, why would I want to have a conversation with a bunch of cis people about like my quote unquote trans art, you know? Like, we could talk about the internet, we could have conversations about things that are a little bit more within that their wheelhouse, I guess. Not to like say that I shouldn't be more forthcoming when I'm making work that's kind of identity based, but it feels weird to have people that don't share or really understand your experience just want to, again, tick that box and then make you talk about that box being ticked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had this playwright on the show about two months ago, and she was basically saying the same thing. She was saying that she looks forward to the day when she can like write a play as a trans woman, and it could just be about her life, and it just doesn't even matter that she's transgender. It's just about her life, you know?
It's like with pronoun circles. I find them very, I usually don't like say things like this, but I find them very violent. Like, it's very much like lets out the trans person in the room. Mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, Jennifer, like, you don't need to know that your pronouns are she, her. Like, mm-hmm. If your pronouns were different, I can assume that you're going to tell me. And I don't want to participate in that. And if you do want to participate, that's great. And I know a lot of trans folks that do want that and do want to tell people so that they don't get misgendered. And I completely understand that. But like, I don't need to know that like Jason in a pair of cargo shorts and flip flops is using like Jason pronouns, you know, like in a baseball cap. We get it. We don't need to like. Just don't refer to me, you know?
Right. Yeah. I wonder how, so I was just before this interview tonight, I'm on a city commission or a planning group or something in the city I live in. And I was on the screen with Zoom with like 36 people. Mm-hmm. And like 32 of them had their pronouns and I didn't have mine. And I wondered, like, how many queer people, especially queer, trans, non-binary people, like, participate in these things where they don't use their pronouns because of what you just said. It's like, it's a great comedy.
You meet a stranger on the street, if you're even at a club or something, and you're with your group of friends, and you, like, walk up, like, are you going to go around and be like, what are your pronouns? Or if you're having, like, a fleeting exactly. conversation while you're smoking a cigarette outside of mm-hmm. a nightclub, like, you don't need to know my business. Like, what?
Exactly. Thank you.
If you Thank do you. Need to know my business, I'll tell you my business. Like, what? That is, like, such a bizarre phenomenon to me. I don't know.
Oh, that's so funny. Thank you. Well, we're just about out of time. We've got, like, maybe 2 minutes left in the show. It just went so fast. Sean, where can people find your work?
You can find my work at seanchamberlain.net, which is seanchamberlain.net. And you can find me on the internet under that name also. I'm just Sean Chamberlain everywhere, basically.
Sean Chamberlain, okay. And they can find your avatar anyways, right?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram under that.
What do you have coming? Do you have any work coming up? Is there anything, you know, coming up soon that people can see works in progress?
I'm in a show. It's a digital show with a curator named Kyle Colmina. I am unfortunate. The name just came in an email to me of the exhibition, but I will probably be. I'm not so much active on Instagram anymore. It's more like sharing resources for me, but I might, like, sneak it in there, or it might be on my website. But that's coming up, and I'll also be doing an artist talk for that, which I will be plugging a little bit on the internet.
Oh, great. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking with you tonight. We've been talking with Sean, who is a visual artist. We've been talking about a whole bunch of issues, including some trans issues. Sean, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Transpositive.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, and have a good night.
You too. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2,
Thank you. Portland.